You're listening to Around Comics, episode 209, brought to you by InStockTrades.com and Witchblade, the anime series. Chicago, this is Around Comics, the comic culture podcast, where each week our revolving panel of guests talk about everything in and around the world of comic books and comics culture. And Around Comics is recorded at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by.
Because this place is dead.
There is
nobody here. No, this is the first, well, other than us.
We're somebody.
But this is the first time in a long time that we've had an empty store to record in.
You know why? Oh,
yeah, because I'm the guest.
Because Don drove everybody away. It's not dead anymore. Who's here?
Mike Norton.
Norton.
Oh, there he is. I was going to say, it's because the weather is so nice here. It's so warm outside. So.
Yeah, well, that's true. It is beautiful outside. God, what?
Maybe
Chicago.
It's my breath. I don't know.
I'll tell you what, let me get everyone introduced here on the panel. I'm Christopher Niesman, and joined alongside Mr. Brian Salazar.
Hello!
How you doing, sir?
I'm good.
You're really
cold,
well.
But good.
And our guest this week, making his triumphant return to Around Comics, Mr.
The
Don
sequel.
Glute.
Sequel.
It is Don Glute, the sequel.
And it's good to be back. I had a great time last time doing that show, and as many times as you want to put me on, when I'm in town? I'm
every week.
Yes.
We want you back every week.
You're on contract. We will pay you a six-pack of beer every time that you're on
of
the
your
show.
Of your choice.
How about a Chicago pizza? That would be better.
We don't have the budget for
no.
it.
No. Okay. Our sponsors don't pay us enough for
all right,
pizza.
I'll just
but
do
speaking,
for free,
of, speaking of sponsors,
yes.
I guess we should mention one of our great sponsors, and they do pay us enough for pizza. Cameron's great.
I don't know. I don't see the money. Chris keeps all that hidden.
Wait, I thought your wife took all the sponsorship money.
Yeah, she does.
So you keep telling me.
Hey, but my kids need clothes, man.
Our sponsor for this episode, as always, is InStockTrades.com. Where waiting for the trade has never been easier. InStockTrades.com offers a huge selection of the collected editions you need. InStockTrades is your source for trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more. All at great discounted prices. And remember that all orders over $50 do, in fact, ship for free.
Sorry, I'm out of the corner of my eye, I'm watching Mike Norton get mauled by Coco the Pit Bull. Nice. Normally, I'd be afraid for Mike, but Coco...
I think Coco should be the one that's afraid.
No, no.
Mike,
they have a very, friendly relationship, Coco and Mike. He's Mike, visiting.
Yeah. Well, we may hear from Mike Norton here
later
in a little while, but we obviously want to talk to our special guests. I believe it was episode 193.
The What If
episode, yes. Which as comic fans, that's largely we know your work from the early Marvel What If stories. But you go back and listen to the episode and we talk about your stuff at Warren and
what was 193, by the way? which was that?
That was the last one. The last time
that was the episode that you were on.
Yeah.
Oh, that was the episode.
Yeah. Not
issue number.
No.
Okay. Right.
Tom might know what. Okay.
What issue?
Did What If get up to 193? I doubt it.
I don't know.
I don't think it went up. I was still writing it if it went up that high.
But we covered a lot of your career as a comics writer, and obviously your career as an amateur and professional filmmaker, which we'll touch on a little bit later. But for this episode, I wanted to talk a little bit with you as being a comic book fan, because
okay.
It's something we've talked about a lot off mic, but it's really some fun stories that I wanted our listeners to be able to experience. So start us off a little bit about when you first started reading comics, and you were here in Chicago at the time.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story, I guess. When I was a little kid, maybe 4 years old or so, this would have been late 1940s. My mother and relatives and various friends would give me comic books. You know, they picked them out. Sometimes we'd go to a friend's house and they would just give me a box of comic books. I know they were mostly Dell comics or DC Comics, National Comics, Superman, that sort of thing. The earliest I remember actually owning was an issue of Tarzan, Dell's Tarzan, where he first went to the Valley of Monsters. And I had that as a kid. It was one of the things that probably affected my interest in dinosaurs. And then I lost it, like I lost a lot of things as a kid. Then I happened to be in it was called Jack Swap Shop. I used to buy a lot of props for my amateur films there. It was over on Southport. And he had old comics. He brought them out, and there was that Tarzan comic, and I got it for a nickel from him. So I was able to get that one back. It had a Jesse Marsh cover, lots of dinosaurs and things in it. And my mother wouldn't let me read the horror comics back then, which I was kind of intrigued by when I saw them on the newsstand. And then one day we went out for a vacation or field trip. My mother's family was very religious. We went out to a place called Holy Hill. Somebody had given me a box of comic books. They were all pre-code horror comics.
Oh, man.
And my mother couldn't understand why. For the first time, I was sitting in the back seat of the car, silent. The whole two-hour drive there and 2 hours. And then she finally saw some of them. She literally threw them all out, burned them or whatever. And I was able to,
comics are worth
I was able to get a lot of them. I was able to get back a lot of those over the years. But I was interested in horror comics. I got really interested in them around 1955, which was the year after the code came in. So they weren't printing them anymore. And I used to get them in these 3-for-a-dime wrapped up cellophane packages that you would get in confectionery stores and candy stores and things like that. And I acquired a huge collection of horror comics without covers. That's when they would tear the cover off.
Yeah.
And but then I kind of got out of comics. I was discovering rock and roll and girls and all these things like a lot of us did. And I was sick. I had something that kept me home from school in bed. I forgot what I had, but my mother went to the store to pick up some medicine or something or other for me. And she brought home, she said, here, you might want to read this. And it was the second or third Showcase Green Lantern story.
Nice.
And I'd never seen a character like that before, because my only recollection of superheroes were Superman and the ones, Aquaman, the ones that were still being published by DC. I had a kind of a vague memory of Captain Marvel, and I knew who the Blue Beetle was from the old Charlton reprints.
Sure.
But Green Lantern, here's a guy who didn't have a cape. He had a mask with no string on it. And when he flew, it wasn't in the Superman pose. He sort of like was floating. I remember there was a story where he was in a parade. He was like floating like a balloon over the street. Uh-huh. And that was so intriguing to me, and the fact that what his power was. That's what kind of brought me back to comic books, especially the superhero comics. And when I got well, I happened to be at the same confectionery store. Walked by the comic book rack. Remember the comic book racks they had in those stores?
Vaguely.
Yeah. And, well, we're all much older than you are. So,
I remember.
And there was something there called the Justice League of America, Starro the Conqueror. And I looked at that, and it was, the Martian Manhunter is in a story with Aquaman and with Wonder Woman and all that. And I know I saw an ad for it. It was in the back. Oh, it was in the Green Lantern comic, I think.
Okay.
That's what it was. It was in
That's JLA 1, the Starro one, right? Where's Tom when you need
him? Yeah, where is Tom when you need him? I think so.
That was JLA 1.
That wasn't the Brave and the Bold or something?
JLA adventure was against Starro the Conqueror. Yeah.
Because I have the third one. I have a copy of like JLA 3.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to remember. I don't know. Yeah, we need Tom.
Yeah. I actually got one until maybe the third tryout issue or whatever. And I remember when I got that book, I slowly turned each page to see those characters in the same. Of course, now it's no big deal. Everything's a crossover. But in those days, seeing like Wonder Woman in the same panel with Batman and the Flash, it was like a really, really big deal. And I just kind of treasured every moment that I turned those pages.
Now, you were talking about,
and that brought me back.
Wow.
Years before that, when you were reading the horror comics and the pre-code horror stuff, I mean, that was really what was popular at the time. Superhero comics was sort of dying out or had died out at that time.
Yeah, but still, what my mother never bought me were Tarzan and, Turok, Son of Stone, because of the dinosaur thing again.
Did you read a lot of war comics?
No, I didn't really. I never liked war comics. I kind of was interested in Sergeant Fury when it first came out, because it was sort of like a superhero book.
Right.
Without the superheroes. and or without the costumes. And I like the World War II Captain America stories.
Okay.
Or stories set in World War II with Spy Smasher, whoever it was, it happened to be. But I never liked the war comics until I bought the first DC Archive Sergeant Rock book.
Okay.
I bought that, and it was the first. Joe, Hubert, if you're out there listening to this, this is the first comic book I ever read where I could hear the sound effects. They were that vivid. Yeah. I could hear those explosions. It was so well done. And I kind of liked Enemy Ace for a while. I didn't read a lot of them because it was always the same story,
right?
You know, with the wolf and then he salutes the guy. I mean, it's always the same plot every single issue. But I like, I'm a big Kubert fan, and I just like the way it was drawn.
I remember the last time that you were here, you were excited because you saw Tor.
I bought it, I'm so glad.
Yeah, they're releasing, he's redoing it.
And so that was it. And I have been out of comics maybe for like the last 10 or 15 years. I think when they went to the slick paper, they really weren't to me comic books anymore. I wanted that newsprint. The stories weren't very good anymore. I got so tired of reading Superman stories where all he did was float through the air having conversations with people, you know. And I just, this isn't Superman, you know. Superman shouldn't float, for one thing. He should be subject to the laws of gravity in some way, you know. He's Peter Pan when he floats, you know.
Sure.
And some of the stories were just close-ups of people grimacing and posing. This isn't worth the money they're charging now for comics.
Yeah. Well,
so I still love the old ones. And, you know, I was into the creepy, eerie thing, too, because they were like the EC books, sort of, you know. I mean, they were horror comics. And I liked stories about werewolves and vampires and zombies and all the things the code wouldn't let you do back then.
Is that sort of what led you into making films about that kind of stuff, or was it the other way around?
Well, I don't know.
Were you already interested in monsters and that kind of
thing?
Well,
the film thing we kind of covered last time. I wanted to make movies and show them on my home screen in the basement or in the house somewhere. And I love the old Universal movies
monsters,
that were coming out, all the monster movies, and I just tried to imitate those.
Okay.
I don't think I ever tried really imitating the comics so much. I drew them. I've got stacks of old comic books I drew when I was a kid, inked, colored, everything. And I did a lot of those with my own characters, introducing the story, my own versions of the Crypt Keeper and the Vault Keeper and all those characters. And so I did a lot of that. I was not just a reader, but I was I drew my own Justice League story, or part of one, until I ran out of swipes I could use, and I was gonna. I actually sent it to Julie Schwartz. It was called the Injustice League of America, and I had all the villains, which just hadn't been done back then.
So you created.
I think there might be some copyright issues here. You might be owed a lot of money.
It was Luthor. It was the Joker. It was Mr. Mystopilic. It was Bizarro. I had Green Lantern turn into a Bizarro. things that weren't done. This was like 1961 or 60, okay, somewhere around there. They were all copied. You know, I found poses, Wayne Boring Superman and Bob Kane's Batman. And
put the best of everything together.
Yeah.
Just everything you
but
like.
I had the Challengers of the Unknown in it. I think Black Hawk was in it.
Everybody
the characters that they weren't using.
Oh, God, it's like a George Perez book.
Yeah, just every character.
Actually, you know, there was a time before the JLA came out, before I even heard of it, and I'd never heard of the Justice Society of America. And as a kid, I started to draw my own comic book version of a league of superheroes. But the only superheroes I knew at the time were Superman, Batman, Green Arrow, and Aquaman, Captain Marvel, and the Blue Beetle. That was it. That's the only characters I knew of. And so those are the characters I started to draw. And I kind of gave up because I didn't have any reference comics of Captain Marvel. I just remembered
the Blue Beetle. Is this Silver Age Blue Beetle?
This is Golden Age Blue Beetle.
Okay.
This is the one that every issue he was different, you know.
Okay. Because Blue Beetle, the Silver Age, that's a Steve Dicko
character. I never liked that. But I had this. That's one of my guilty pleasures of life. The old original Blue Beetle that looked different from panel to panel, and you know, you never could tell. And that was to me one of the appeals of it. Like trying to figure out some continuity there that didn't exist. I spent hours.
So you were one of the original continuity freaks.
Why? Well, I don't mean continuity from story to story, but why is in this story he can fly, and in this story, you know, he's driving a car, and in this story he's growing to giant size, and this story he's basically Superman with X-ray vision. He was like different every story, and that was somehow appealing to me.
That would make a lot of comic book fans today that would just blow their mind. Yeah.
Wouldn't be able to deal with it too well.
But now as a writer, I could figure out some way of explaining it all. I'm really good at figuring out, rationalizing things.
Well, these are a lot of DC books that you grew up with. When, because I know that a lot of your, not just your amateur, but your, you know, early professional movies, whenever you're, well, not professional, I want to say whenever you're more in like film school, you did a lot of Marvel characters.
Yeah,
When did Marvel come into your, you know, your fandom?
Well, I liked the pre-code horror stuff they did, even though I was getting it in those three for a dime packs, mm-hmm. Because I wasn't allowed to buy horror comics when I was a kid, and then I kind of discovered the giant monster books and some of the things like the kind of fantasy things that retain the horror titles,
right?
Like,
yeah, because there was that transition period.
Yeah,
because the horror titles were still selling well; they were bringing in more sci-fi fantasy stuff.
Amazing Fantasy, so I was
reading it. Yeah, I would flip through to see if there were dinosaurs. If there were dinosaurs in there, I bought
that.
The
was
comic.
Good. It was that was gold.
And then what I used to call, what we used to call on our block, the Behold comics, which were the big giant, you know, the Kirby with the giant monsters like Goo Gam with the swimming trunks, and they always said Behold, behold, I am so and so, and I love those. And I'm so glad they're reprinting those now in those books, because I'm reading them all over again. And I love the Ditko stories in the back with the twist endings. And
right.
So I bought a lot of those. And then when, you know, FF number one and the first Spider-Man and Amazing Fantasy came out.
15,
yeah, that's what kind of hooked me. I didn't particularly, they always look kind of dark to me. The colors are always kind of brown
muddy,
and things and purples and.
They had a lot of printing issues at Marvel in the early.
Well, I think Fantastic Four. That's one of those. That's one of those books that kind of combined what you were like.
It looked like a monster book to me.
Right,
I mean, that's why the Thing was in there, is because they wanted to.
Oh, and that first issue, that first cover, the giant monster coming out of the sewers, and
but it was also a team book. Which, if you go back and listen to, like, you know, Stan Lee talk about it, I think it was, who was his, Martin Goodman was his father-in-law, right?
Yes, I believe it was his father.
And who owned Marvel and Timely and all that, saw the sales numbers on JLA and said, hey, we got to get a team book. And so they go and they, you know, but monster books sold well. So it was combining superhero team books and monster
hedging
books.
Hedging their bets.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'd never heard of the Human Torch. I didn't know there was a Golden Age Human Torch.
Right.
To me, that was the only Human Torch, you know. And then I heard, you know, kind of oblique references to a Golden Age Human Torch and fanzines and things. And then I just went with the flow, you know, when the Hulk and Iron Man and all these other things, and then Captain America. I knew Captain America because I had an old coverless, again, bought in one of these three for dime packs, of a 1950s Captain America.
Wow.
One of those 50s revival stories. I had one of those. And so I kind of knew who Captain America was, but just kind of vaguely. I didn't know what the history of the character was, or let alone I never knew I'd be writing the character someday. So I became a comic fan for many years, and I became a professional writing them, and then after a while I just kind of got tired of it.
Mm-hmm. When you were writing comics, were you still a fan at that time? You know, when you were actually working
of certain things, there were a lot of. I was never a fan of Sword and Sorcery, even though I wrote an awful lot of it. To me, Sword and Sorcery, just like, Enemy Ace, it was always
same
the same
thing.
Story. Every Sword and Sorcery story to me is the same plot. You've got some wizard who has captured some beautiful girl in order to get something, a jewel or something, which when he gets this, he's going to command the dark forces or whatever. He's going to command something. And then there's some barbarian hero who they all look alike, you know, with a sword, and he cleaves his way through
this explains
walls of human flesh.
This explains a lot of the Masters of the Universe stuff that you worked on.
Yeah, that was just the same old stuff. I mean, it was just the old basic plot, and it's basically kind of like a Western plot, really.
Right.
You've got the guy who's
comes
in the
town,
suit who lives who works in the saloon. He wants to get the land off of the homesteader, so he sends his thugs out. Whatever, he captures the sheriff's daughter or whatever, and then Gene Autry or whoever it is goes after him. Sings a song but
speaking of Masters of the Universe, I mean, you were heavily involved in the development of that.
Well, no, I was.
You
hired.
Came up with the name for Grayskull.
Yeah, named that to my ex-wife. I was hired to whose maiden name was Gray. They called me up. They said, "We've got this." I was working for Gold Key, which was part of Western Publishing Company, which had the Mattel toy account.
Right.
And they said, "Look, we're doing this thing called the Masters of the Universe. We need somebody to write the little booklets. There's like six of them or something." And I brought
because the toys came with the
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And I brought Alfredo El Collin to illustrate them. And most of the characters didn't have names yet. There were no female characters. They said no little boy is going to buy a girl doll. But then when I showed them how the female character made the story work, then they got the idea, well, if we make, we can use the same mold and we can make five different characters, which is what they did with the male characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I said, what are they called? They said, Masters of the Universe, and the lead character is about one of the only characters we have a name for. It was called He-Man. I said, He-Man? That sounds like, like the guy that kicks sand in your face on the beach in those old Charles Atlas ads. And I thought it was just ridiculous. It had kind of a gay sound to it, too. He-Man, So, the money was good, and so I did it. And then I was going to, as I said, as a joke, I suggested that the female character be called She-Man. Well, they didn't like that at all. They took it very seriously. But some of the names...
They had toys to sell.
Yeah. So I named her... I didn't want to put too much thought into it because I wasn't getting a piece of the action. It would just work for hire, and they're going to make toys out of these things. So I named her Tila, which was the name that popped into my head. It was the name of the elephant that was written by a character called Ganga Rum, which was a story that used to run on the old Smiling Ed's Gang TV show, and then it became Andy's Gang. And his... elephant was named Tila, so I named the elephant Tila. The photo they showed me of the castle was a bad Polaroid, and the photo looked gray. It turned out it was green, but so I named it Gray Skull after Linda Gray, my ex-wife's maiden name, and then some of the other characters. I made up Merman, or I can't remember what the other ones were. Eternia was just kind of a.
They just kept pumping out.
It was a name like, it's an eternal place. Call it Eternia, like Fantasia or something. Then the weird thing that happened later was then I got divorced. And right after my divorce was really hit home, I happened to be in a Toys R Us. And there staring me in the face is Castle Grayskull. And it was like adding insult to injury. I knew I wasn't getting extra money because I could see what a giant that was becoming. Yeah. I was thinking of my ex-wife right then and there. And then I said, it's green. Why didn't they change the name to Green Skull? But they didn't do that. Then the really weird thing.
I kind of wondered that when I was a kid. I'm like, why is this thing called Gray Skull? It's green.
But the really bizarre thing was about 5 or 6, back in the 1970s, I worked for Filmation.
Okay.
And one of the producers at Filmation who produced the Masters of the Universe TV show was a guy named Joe Matucha, mm-hmm. or something. I don't know how you pronounce it. And I was at Filmation a lot, walking to the corridors. I probably passed him many, many times. I was never able to get on the Masters of the Universe cartoon show, which is a whole other story in itself. But it turns out, and I found this out a few months after he died, so I was never able to go up and tell him this, Joe Matucha was the kid, then using the name Nino Marcel, who played Ganga Rum, the elephant boy who rode Tila on the show. And now
no
I wonder, did he ever wonder
if
Tila. Why, could that possibly be connected with my old TV show? And it's just one of those
just
weird
one of those weird
things
weird
that
happenstance. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking about, buying comics and whatnot a little bit earlier, and Sal and I are kind of a part of this bridge generation that can remember going to 7-Eleven. Mine was
pharmacy.
I would go to the Hux, which is the 7-Eleven down in Southern Illinois. And then somewhere along the line, as we were growing up, these comics went out of the pharmacies and the Stop and Shops and popped up the comic book stores. Where did you shop for comics whenever you were growing up? One place that you went?
When I was a kid, you bought them wherever you could find them. Mm. You could find them pretty much everywhere. I was riding the subway, and I was thinking how when I was a kid I would. Right, I would get off certain stops in the subway temporarily because they had the newsstands, and at the newsstand they had all the comics.
Right.
When I walked around downtown or around Lincoln and Belmont, there were newsstands on the corner with racks of comic books. You could go to a confectionery store or a dime store, Woolworth, Kresge's. They had comic books in their stores, and but that's all gone now. It's funny because in those days, you could go and buy 10 copies of a comic book with no problem. I have friends who own comic book shops. I never talked to Mark about this at Dark Tower, but I spoke to people in California where a guy wants to come in and buy two issues, a comic book, two copies, and the store owner won't sell it to him, even though he would be making some money, because he only orders enough for his finite number of regular buyers.
Right.
And if he doesn't have that book when that guy comes in, that guy's going to lose that customer. He's going to go down the street, and that's going to become his new store. So it's a very strange thing where you can't really
sell more
of them if you want to.
You know, you're talking about you'd buy those three issues that they'd rip the cover off, and that was because they'd rip the cover off
and send
it
credit.
Back.
Yeah, and get credit for it.
And that you know, stopped happening where comic shop owners now, if they order it, nobody buys it.
And I think that was illegal, actually, doing that. I think that was illegal practice. You're supposed to destroy those, right?
Yeah.
But somebody found them, and they would package them up in these cheap...
quote-unquote found them.
Well, because you would just send the covers back. That was the thing, so, yeah.
But and then they
sell them to you.
But once I got one with a cover, and once I got one with a half a cover. So I lucked out a couple times.
But you hear stories about kids in the 50s, 60s, and even 70s that they would go to this store and that store, and it was some months they would get these comics.
Oh,
and
when I was a kid, there was a pharmacy and a 7-Eleven right by my house within walking distance, and each one of them carried different comics, and so I would go to both and buy different comics, and then there would be other stores. Here or there that, you would just find. And then, when the first comic shop opened, it was like, the Holy Grail.
It's all here.
But now back issues was a whole different story.
Yeah, that was a whole,
There were like two venues for back issues. One was just you would find the old swap shop or junk shop. And they usually sold for 5 cents a piece because comics then were a dime. Mm-hmm. So they sold for half price. I remember going to one and the guy had a whole stack of horror comics. And he said to me, he was one of these typical guys in those oceans, with the cigar in his mouth and the visor, and he's got the broke pieces of pizza sitting there, and a dark store, and he said, I got a guy who's got a whole collection of ECs he'll sell me, but he wants a dime a piece for him.
Oh, God.
That means I got to sell him for 15 cents, and nobody's going to spend 15 cents on a comic book. Then I discovered I used to buy my makeup supplies for my amateur movies, for my monster makeups, around Hubbard Street, down right before you cross over the bridge downtown.
Okay.
And I discovered Osville's bookstore, ABC bookstore, and Acme bookstore. Osville was a crazy guy. He was, in fact, I have a character in my new movie named Mr. Osville, who runs a collectible shop. And his client, who I play, is Mr. Sarno, the name of Joe Sarno.
Mm-hmm.
But Osville had everything. I went in there to see if he had Superman number one. He had three copies.
Jeez.
His standard price was $15. But if it was mint, whatever it was like $30. He had three copies of Superman number one at the same time. One was a fair copy for $15. One was a really good copy for $25, I think it was, or $30. And then he had a mint copy for $50. I found across the street the same day, at the Acme bookstore, a really good, but not mint.
Right.
I wouldn't even say a fine, but a really good copy for $15, which I bought. Everybody told me I was crazy for spending $15.
For spending
for
that much.
And now, if I had
the
bought the other three, I could be financing my own movie.
Yeah, no kidding.
But those were the places you went for the back issues. And there was also a couple places across the bridge. There was a place on Washington Boulevard. I forgot what that was called, but they had a lot of comic books and old comics and movie stills. So that I discovered later on. It was much later that, you know, people like the Rockets Blast, people were selling comics mail order.
Right.
And then I started looking, getting things mail order and at conventions and places like that.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, did you start going to conventions at all? Were you going to conventions at all as a professional writer? Or
no, I went as a fan the first time. I was in California visiting Forry Ackerman for the first time in 1962. And he told me, he said, "Are you going to the science fiction convention?" I said, what's that? And he said, "Well, it's just a couple months away. It'll be in Chicago. I'll be there." And that's what was my first convention, the World Science Fiction Convention. It was, you know, it was basically science fiction, but the Burroughs fans were there, the Pulp magazine fans,
right.
the comic fans. That's before they had comic book conventions.
Yeah.
And you go to the dealer's room.
Nostalgia show.
Mm-hmm. People did, like Dick Lupoff would be selling comic books. And I remember I was there. They had a mint copy of Spy Smasher number 1 for $5. And I said, I don't want to spend that today. I can always buy one of those.
Always find that.
I've never seen one since, which created in me the belief that if you see something like that, even if it's a little overpriced and it's really rare, you buy it then, or you may never see it again.
Right.
You know, you bite the bullet. And...
Yeah, true. No, I mean, you just never know. I mean, I think all of us as comic fans. I mean, it's strange today because, like, issues that come out today, it's almost, you know, more than likely nothing's going to be worth any, you know, of any value.
Yeah, because everybody's buying them.
Everybody's buying them. They
make too many.
They publish so many.
There's no paper drives going on where people
are, or
Wortham scares or anything like that.
And you know, but when I was a kid, you know, it's like I could have bought a lot of comic books.
I could have bought X-Men number 1 for $150.
Well, that's what I mean. There's just so many things that you look back on, but you don't, you know, like I said, it was $15 or $10. Like, oh, I'm not paying $10 for a comic book. You know, that was crazy when I was a kid, but you look back on it now, it's like, oh my God, you know, what you could have. But that's also part, I think, of what led to those values is because, you know, like you said, your mom threw out your comics, burned them, whatever. I mean, how many, you know, stories like that have we all probably
when you come
heard
back
of...
from summer camp and your mom says, like, I did this for you, I cleaned your room for you.
No! I probably have three relatives that have over the years told me when they find out that I was a comic book fan, oh yeah, I used to have boxes of those comics and I don't know whatever happened to them, they got thrown out, or you know, and it's just like, oh, you know, me, I'm just sitting there like cringing at that story. No, why? But talking a little bit more about your movie work, you have a new movie coming out.
Well,
it's been out since
April. It premiered here in Chicago at the Music Box Theater. It's called Blood Scarab. Mm-hmm. It's a sequel to four other movies we did, two Countess Dracula movies and two Mummy's Kiss movies. And Blood Scarab will be returning a week from tonight. This is a Friday, so I don't know when this is going to air.
This will come out on Monday, so it'll be
The
Friday.
The night after Thanksgiving.
Friday after Thanksgiving.
Black Friday, I guess they call it, for shopping.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good title for our screening.
Sure.
It's going to be a double bill of Blood Scarab, which is our newest movie, with our first movie, Dinosaur Valley Girls.
Okay.
And it's going to be hosted by Count Gore Duvall, the famous horror host, who's coming in from Washington to do this. And he'll be in character, costume, and everything. And it ought to be a lot of fun. We'll have DVDs there for sale.
No, Senesven Gulli, the local guys. Yeah,
well,
Sven
I'm
Gulli.
Good friends with Count Gore Duvall. Sven Gulli, I don't know. I've never met him. And
Blood Scarab, a vampire's craving, a mummy's curse.
It looks good to me.
First time in history, I think a mummy ever fights a female vampire.
Very nice. Very nice.
It's a two series kind of combined. I took the Countess Dracula series characters and I crossed them over with the Mummy's Kiss character. So it's like Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, or Godzilla versus Mothra, or Freddy versus Jason, Alien versus Predator, one of those types.
Now, your first, the first film you said, I'm sorry, it was Dinosaurs.
Dinosaur Valley.
Dinosaur. Yeah. When did you make that?
Well, we shot that, I think it was in 94, came out, I think, 96, after post-production, and we finally found a distributor for it.
So that was your first?
That was our first professional
work.
Yeah.
You obviously made tons of films before that.
Lots of amateur films before
that.
Which, speaking of real quickly, and if you go back and listen to our last episode with Don, we talk about it at length, but there is a collection of all of your amateur movies, and it's a great two-disc set. It has a really nice documentary on it as well, and it's called I Was a Teenage Movie Maker, Don Glut's Amateur Movies.
Yeah, and there's also a book with the same title, which kind of fills in all the blanks. I mean, there's only so much I could put on the DVD, and it had to be visual.
Right.
A lot of them are cerebral things, the emotional things, and things that wouldn't have translated well to a documentary, just people talking, are covered in the book. And all the mistakes I made in there, factual mistakes, are corrected in the book. There's also a soundtrack CD with the same title, I Was a Teenage Movie Maker, which is the music that I, with a friend, wrote and recorded because I couldn't afford to buy the music I used to play along, you know, the records I used to play along with the movies when I ran them as a teenager. We recorded an album's worth of stuff, and some of that music is also in Blood Scarab. There's a scene where somebody's listening to a radio, and it's one of those songs.
Well, speaking on some of the amateur movies, Monday, before we start recording tonight, you talked about another Chicagoan, Doug Munch.
Yeah, Doug Munch is in one of these movies. He's in Spy Smasher versus the Purple Monster, and he gets shot in the movie. That's when I first met him, and.
But you guys didn't meet in Chicago.
Yeah, we did meet in Chicago.
Oh, you did?
A year before I left for California, before I moved out to California. So this would have been around 1963, 64. And we had a screening in my basement. I think we rented some old movie serials or something. We all chipped in. It was Captain America, the Republic serial. And he was the first guy that showed up. And we had a conversation, and that's how I met Doug Munch. And then the way he got in the comic book business was I was writing for Warren, and I wrote to Doug. I said, hey, I'm writing for Warren now. And Doug said, I can write as good as Don. So he submitted some stuff, and he sold it, and that's how his career.
Wow. That's did he create Moon Knight, or just wrote Moon Knight for a really long time?
I think he created it, because he's involved in some kind of, lawsuit. It's not a lawsuit.
He's involved with something.
There's some kind of thing they're going to do, a TV show or something, and he's hoping to get it.
I believe he did create it.
Well, that was Werewolf by Night, so I didn't know if that was...
Some of those things, Doug came in later. He didn't come in at the ground floor, but I think on Moon Knight, that was
it. I think he created that character.
If not created, he definitely his stamp is all over.
Mm. I believe he did. Yeah. I believe he did create Moon Knight. Okay. If I remember correctly.
Fact checkers.
Yeah, we'll
get out there, but yeah, it's
my memories.
So Moon Knight may be a byproduct of him thinking that he could write just as well, if not better, than you, huh?
Well, that's certainly one of the things that led to Moon Knight. Some of those things, you know, just like the things I did, kind of led to me, to my early stuff that I did. You know, I mean, I started writing those Warren stories, and that's where my comic book career actually began. You know, writing for Creepy Nearing Vampirella.
Did you ever, as a fan, you know, when you first started out writing comics, did you ever have any sort of fan moments, meeting any of the guys that you? Well, I mean, it might have been different that time, because when you were reading comics then,
I can't believe this guy has drawn my story.
When the first issue, the first stuff, let me see. So among the first things I ever did was I wrote a lot of the stories in Vampirella number one, and there was a story drawn by Reed Crandall. One by Neil Adams, and that just both blew me away. You know, the fan kicked in.
I'm picking this. I'm buying this tonight.
Speaking of Neil,
this is the Treasury edition.
Limited collector's edition of Batman. That's oversized and with a great Neil Adams cover on it.
Yeah, this is the one with the shirtless, hairy-chested Batman there fighting Ra's al Ghul.
Yeah, so there were some of my idols over the years. Yeah, you know, Steve Ditko did one of my stories, at least one of them, for Charlton, of all places. And then it's kind of a thrill. Still haven't gotten Joe Kubert to draw one? Or?
Hey, man, there's still time.
He's still doing it.
He's my favorite. I admire him so much. I mean, he's so good.
And he's still got it.
He was one of the guys that when I was a kid. I mean, obviously he had been doing comics for years by the time I started reading them. But I mean, he was one of those guys that just stuck. But
he's not just really good. There's something really special about him.
Yeah.
There's like a real integrity there that is lacking in so many other people that can draw well. But he's got He puts a real emotional content in.
Well, his storytelling ability is, to me, some of the best I think I've ever seen in comics. Is his pacing and ability to... I mean, he thinks about what he's drawing so much more than I think other artists do. And how to tell the story without forcing it and using every part of a panel to do that.
He's a real master. Yeah.
You had pointed this out to me a couple years ago when he came back to Sergeant Rock, and that opening spread in the new Sergeant Rock that he was doing was a scene of these paratroopers jumping out of an airplane and just how the parachutes just flow down the page mm-hmm. and just how he lays out.
Oh, he's amazing.
He's a master.
Yeah,
he's a master.
Absolutely. I don't think enough guys.
And his Tor comic was so influential on my dinosaur interest
yeah.
as a kid. I mean, that and the movie The Beast in 20,000 Fathoms were the two. I mean, there were other things too.
Sure.
But those were the two main jump starts with me. And I can't thank Ray Harryhausen and Joe Kubert enough for the inspiration they gave me, because that led to a whole secondary career in dinosaurs and paleontology. Mm-hmm. If you should see my house is a museum. It's cluttered. I don't collect comics anymore, but I collect dinosaur stuff. It literally is a museum. And there's a website now called Collector's Quest that called me recently or emailed me, and they said, "We heard you have some dinosaur stuff. Would you like to put it on the?" We have a minimum of 12 photos. I'm up to about 196 already, and still adding things.
No kidding.
And I'm shooting groups of things because I can't minimize it too much. Otherwise, it would be like 3,000 photographs. So here's all the stuff from here's a shelf with everything with three collections on it, and it's enormous. Every nook and cranny is cluttered with dinosaurs or prehistoric.
Now, is that? Do you think? I mean, obviously your fascination with monsters, and I would imagine. I mean, because dinosaurs.
They're real monsters.
They're real monsters. That's what I was going to say.
When you discover them as kids, they're fantasy characters,
right.
basically. Then somewhere along the line, people like me realize that, hey, they're real.
They existed.
And then you find out that the reality is even more interesting than the science. Mm-hmm. The science is more interesting than the fantasy.
Have you heard that they recently decoded the DNA of a woolly mammoth and that they think they can actually...
They just
were able to decode from some fossil or DNA of a woolly mammoth, and they think that they can actually clone it now.
Didn't they watch Jurassic Park?
I know, that's
it's the Jeff Goldblum line.
But I mean, that'd be pretty amazing.
Our unofficial slogan for Dinosaur Valley Girls, because there's a lot of sexy girls in it, was, you heard of dinosaur DNA, now it's dinosaur TNA. We didn't put that on the poster, but that was like, behind the scenes.
When you, with your amateur stuff, and like I said, unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to watch your DVD.
No, because you still have your eyesight. That's why.
But, doing that stuff, I mean, was that mostly for you as a learning experience? Were you trying to get this stuff seen? Did you get it seen in a lot of places?
Well, I grew up in Chicago. A lot of people in Chicago don't, when they're talented or have abilities, don't seem to understand that they can do this for a day job someday. They look at it as hobbies.
Right.
So back then, until I discovered there was such a thing as USC Film School and I could actually get into business somewhere, I think I was looking at it as just kind of a cool hobby I had. And I had no idea what I was going to do when I got out of college. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the foggiest idea. And it was just something I did for fun, and I was trying to get better at it. And I just loved making movies. It was something that satisfied me. It was a creative urge I used to have to follow through on. And I don't think I was really thinking of it as a career, because I believe, like so many other people, that it doesn't happen to people here. It
right.
happens to people who live out the West Coast and are related to someone, and which is not true. It happens to people who realize it. It's Doug Munch is a good example. Doug wanted to make a career of being a writer,
mm-hmm.
and that's what he did, where other people didn't. They dabbled at it, or maybe they just collected comics or something, but they never gave their talent a time to develop or gave it a shot, a real good shot. So I don't know if back then I probably had a dream in the back of my head, I'd love to do this for
sure.
a living, but then I didn't know what I wanted to do, because I loved it all. I loved doing the makeups, the acting, the stunt work, the special effects,
right.
the editing, the
complete
camera work.
Process,
I love doing it all.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest problems I had when we shot Dinosaur Valley Girls was finally realizing that I couldn't do all those things, that we actually hired people to do those things. And I was like, we would break a set and I would start to move huge props and 10 guys would descend on me and say, "You can't do that. That's not your job. That's our job. We're getting paid for that."
Unions, man.
Yeah. Well, ours was non-union. But it was hard for me to, because I had experience in all these other areas.
You had done it all. So
yeah, to realize that these other people, I had to trust these other people to do what I would have done before.
Sure.
And everything was a lot easier once I reached that realization.
Right. Uh,
You've written a lot of books also, right? I mean,
about 65
books.
One that we didn't talk about last time, which I think definitely bears talking about, is you were the author of the novelization of Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, I was.
So, which is probably still in print, and
after all these decades, you know, it still opens doors because.
How did you get hooked up? Writing the follow-up to Star Wars.
It's not the rumor, the myth is that because I went to school with George Lucas, that he gave me the gig. That is not true. He didn't even know I was writing it until after the contracts were signed, and his editors came up and he said, well, I didn't know Don would want to do this book because he turned down Star Wars, which I did. Now, the story, here's the true story. I heard that they were doing Star Wars back in the, when was it, early 70s, 70, middle 70s?
77, yeah.
Well, 77 when it came out.
So and a friend of mine said, call Lucas, see if you can get some kind of work. I said, what am I going to do? I'm not a special effects guy or anything. So I called him up and he said, well, the only thing that we have available is the novelization. But I got to tell you, it's a crummy deal. It's going to be ghostwritten. My name will go on it. Lucas's name will go on it. We're paying $1,000 flat, no royalties.
Oh.
And I said, that's a pretty crummy deal. I said, no, I'll pass on that.
But at the time, nobody knew what Star Wars was going to be.
In the meantime, between then and Empire Strikes Back, I kicked myself. I said, look at what this has become. I used to think of Bela Lugosi turning down Frankenstein in 1931 and letting Boris Karloff become the big star.
Sure.
And then over the next few years, I got involved in some of the other Star Wars things. I was writing some of the comic books for Marvel.
Okay.
I got involved with Russ Manning. I was going to write some of the newspaper strips that he was illustrating. Right. And I loved Russ. Russ is one of the greatest guys in the world. And I learned so much about writing comics from Russ. And then I got a call from, I don't know if they called them or if they called me, but I was connected with the Lucas editorial division that were doing all the books and things. And they wanted me to write a character novel, a Wookiee novel. And I hate writing novels. They're painful for me. They're hard to do. I don't feel I'm really good at it. I just don't like writing novels. They're time-consuming. So I thought I could make the thing easier and pass some of the workload over if I co-wrote it. So I could, can I bring in a co-writer? He's got a lot of credits. He's written some other novels. It was Jerry Conway. So Jerry and I sat down. We went to a pizza place, and we plotted out this Wookiee novel set on the Wookiee planet, whatever it was called. And,
or a better nerd, I would know that.
Yeah, and we listen, today I was giving a talk. I couldn't remember Carrie Fisher or Mark Hamill's name. That's another story. So we submitted the plot. They liked the plot. And then they kept stringing us along. They wouldn't say yes or no about the plot of this novel. And then I didn't know that in the meantime, Craig Miller, who's now an animation writer, but at that time was working in Lucas's editorial office. And before that, he was the guy who went around the conventions, and if he saw you with an amateur Darth Vader helmet, he threatened you with a lawsuit. That's what he did before. He was one of those guys. And he knew they were looking for somebody to write the Empire Strikes Back novel. And he was trying to get one of his science fiction writer friends the gig.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Larry Niven was one, Jerry Purnell, I don't know who the others were. So he submitted a lot of stuff by all of us to the powers that be. And they read all of it, and they liked something of mine. They said what they liked of mine was a sense of humor. I don't know what they read. I have no idea what they read of mine. And they called me up, and they said, look, we'd like you to talk to you about writing the Empire Strikes Back novelization. Like, whoa. And I said, we're going to take you out to lunch to this Japanese restaurant. Now, lesson number one you learn when you're freelancing is you never turn down a free lunch, even if you don't get the job. So I said, well, I'm probably not going to get the job, but they're going to, at least I will get this
feed
lunch.
You.
So I went to this, and we went there, and they offered it to me, and they offered me a certain amount of money. And I don't remember now if they called me and mentioned The Empire Strikes Back or if that happened at lunch. I think they mentioned the title at lunch, now that I think of it.
Okay, so you didn't even know.
We have this project we want you to do. Yeah, and we'd like to write The Empire Strikes Back.
Now, is this after the movie had come out? Is this before?
They were just starting to shoot it.
Okay.
And so,
because they wanted the novel to come out basically at the same time.
Yeah. It came out a week before.
Oh, did it? Okay.
Turned out. So they made me this, and I did this double take. I said, yeah, the offer they made me was not really great. It was a pretty
better than the Star Wars offer?
It was better than that. not a whole lot better. Yeah. And the thing was, they were kind of arrogant. It was like, you know, well, if you turn it down,
we'll get somebody else.
People pay us to write this book.
Right.
And it's already sold 1.5 million copies in advance copies. So you already got a bestseller here. So I said, okay, I'll do it because I figured it would open up some doors.
Sure.
And so I did it. And it has opened up doors. And that's basically how it all came about.
So
it's been in print ever since.
What was the process then of the novelization?
How I did it?
Yeah, how you did it.
Well, this is a story in itself. My God, this is in the days before computers too, electric typewriters. I didn't have a Selectric yet, so it was with the whiteout, the liquid paper,
right.
You know, that Michael Nesmith's mother invented. And I wrote
Michael Nesmith from the Monkey.
I used to work for
a pen company.
You used to work for?
I used to work for Michael Nesmith.
No kidding.
I was in a band that he produced, which is another story. But sticking to this
stories.
One for now, the paranoia. Was unbelievable.
Of the getting the script out, not leaking
the, they
it.
They gave
something.
Me the script. Each one was numbered and somehow coded that if I made a Xerox or something, a light would go off in the back of Lucas's head or something, and the stormtroopers would come into my house and kill me. So the people that worked at the company were, I'll never forget, they took me into a van. It was like a trailer.
Did they blindfold you?
Yeah, put a bag over you.
But they locked me in for 2 hours with the storyboard art, the Macquarie paintings, and the whatever stills had been shot at that time.
Okay.
And I was supposed to look at it to get the idea what the visuals were. And I was frantic. I didn't know what to do. I only had 2 hours. Maybe it was less than that, but it was like during lunch period or something.
And you're not walking out of there with any of that stuff. It's whatever
and
you can memorize.
I found some notebook paper, and I found a ballpoint pen, and I started drawing pictures of Yoda and things down so I would know what these things looked like. The funniest thing was I found these stills, and they had still numbers. And I was in such haste that there was these Ugnaughts or whatever they called. I forgot what they were called, but... these strange-looking characters and phony rubber headpieces. Uh-huh. And I thought these numbers, the 0 looked like an O, the 5 looked kind of like an S.
Those are their names.
And I wrote the words, something like Squoo Cruise down there. I was writing numbers, but I thought I was writing letters. And
they're obviously frantic at this point.
I got out of there, and I said, first of all, is this Yoda? Everybody, don't tell us. We're not supposed to know the names. We're not supposed to know the names. We're allowed to read the script. But we can't see the picture that relates to it. You're either allowed to see the picture or we can't see both.
So you may be the only guy other than Lucas.
And it was like, you remember in Bambi when man is in the forest and everybody came? That was like, that's how it was like working at Lucas. Everybody, George.
Right, you know.
But suddenly, George is in the building. And everybody was just terrified of offending him or saying anything about one of the characters that might be misconstrued, you know? So anyway.
I think we've
realized why Jar Jar Binks exists.
Yeah. So while we were there, while I was there, they showed me. I had to somehow make some sense out of all this. They showed me a context that was going on at the time, which was draw your favorite cartoon of your favorite Star Wars characters.
Okay.
And then they had the censored board that kind of ran interference, so Lucas wouldn't see the offensive ones because he took those characters very seriously. And there was one where there was you remember where Luke swings across the chasm with Princess Leia? There was a picture there, and Luke was up there and he had Leia, and at the bottom of the pit was like 50 dead Leias, and then then they had Lucas with the megaphone going, all right, take 51. And they were laughing about this, but they didn't want him to see this. And the one I suggested was to have, what's his name, the Wookiee,
Chewbacca,
walking by R2-D2, who looked sort of like a fire plug, and starting to raise his leg, you know. They didn't want to hear about that either. So I went home and I wrote the novel. I did 3 complete drafts.
So hold up before you go. So you had 2 hours in this trailer.
Yeah.
And then nothing. I mean, they didn't let you take the script.
No, I had the script.
You had the script.
Which
okay,
I couldn't show anyone.
Right.
And all my friends are fans.
Oh, yeah.
And they're begging, beating down the door, trying to find out what's
what's going to happen, yeah.
The ending.
My God, you know.
The Darth Vader thing. Even I met with Lucas once. We had lunch, and we're at a restaurant in Hollywood. And he's telling me all this stuff about Darth Vader being the father of Luke. And he's laughing, and he's got this loud voice. No problem. But everybody who worked for him was, like, terrified.
Paranoid about it,
And I got the script. And the ending made no sense. It had nothing to do with him being his father or anything. And even though I knew what the ending was. So I had to keep rewriting the ending as the new phony
new pages
script pages.
Were coming. Oh,
so everybody,
okay.
Whoever read the book, would think that this was the way the movie was going to end.
Even so the script they gave you to write the book was not
different.
No,
it was different than the actual... Than the
right, a different ending. And I kept getting different versions. I kept changing the ending. And then there were other things that they had me... take out because the movie was running too long. So there's a lot of stuff with the ice monsters and everything. One of the things I did was I knew Mark Hamill was in that car accident.
Right.
And I knew that they were doing
reconstructive.
This, even though they wouldn't admit it, the reason they had him in that tank, and he looks a little different when he comes out, was to sort of cover their bases for the car accident. And in fact, he didn't look like he did in Star Wars. And I actually elaborated on that in my book. And they made me take that out.
No kidding.
Now, I did three full drafts. The first draft was very literate. It was written like a real novel would be written.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't like that. They wanted it to be more like, you know, Luke, Han Solo walked in the room. He whipped out his gun. He fired.
Like
it zapped.
Pulp, like a pulp.
Like a pulp action
thing.
So I did a second version again. Then we finally did the final draft, which had all their notes written all over it.
Mm.
And I'll never forget. It was due the next morning. I was in my office. I was married then. My wife was running pages right off the typewriter to the editor who was sitting on my couch making the corrections to go to the publisher or the printing the next morning. And then she said at one point, "What? I'm curious. What are these school cruise things you keep referring to?" Because I wrote that. I wrote that into the novel as a character. And I said, "Well, they were on the." And it turned out then I found that they were still. Negative numbers that I misinterpreted.
I want to know what characters those were.
They were the Ugnaughts. They were on the Sky City, and they were like they looked like they were probably
dwarfs
or little people or something, with the kind of big scowling Paul Blaisdell type faces.
Yeah, they were the Cloud City workers.
That's funny.
And so that mystery got solved. A couple mistakes got in. I'd forgotten that Darth Vader had a red light on his lightsaber.
Mm-hmm.
And I had them both green, and then nobody caught that. The TIE fighters, I don't even know if they were, though that was sort of an informal name. I found out a year later that they were called TIE fighters because they looked like bow ties.
Right, right.
You know? And what were the other ones? The TIE fighters and
the X-Wings.
The X-Wings were obvious.
Yeah.
But they looked like bow ties, and that's why they called them that. So I don't know if they were supposed to be called that or not, but that's what I called them in the book, and it stuck.
No shit.
That's my experience writing Empire Strikes Back.
Now, you've mentioned your...
is why every movie I make pretty much has a reference to... Because I did not have a good experience with the Lucas organization after that. And I'm not ashamed to say it because I know they're never going to hire me again anyway.
Right.
And so every one of my movies has a reference to a mythical movie that doesn't exist called The Vampire Strikes Back. So that's in there. A guy will be in the bookstore looking for that book or... In Blood Scarab, somebody rents the DVD starring Tony Markham, who was the actor in Dinosaur Valley Girls who goes back through time. So all these things are connected. There's continuity. I have continuity that runs from all my novels, all my movies, through my amateur films, my short stories, Marvel Comics, Gold Key Comics, DC Comics, Charlton Comics, et cetera. It's all one universe to me. And I have all these subtle things. I have characters from my Gold Key Comics losing their memory and turning up in Marvel Comics under a different name. Then they go back to Gold Key with their real name. They get their memory back. I did a Rutland, Vermont story. I had a lot of fun with this.
Well, one of the things that, you know, I was disappointed that Sal wasn't here whenever we talked with you the first time around, because he is a huge Agents of Atlas fan.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Don created that team.
I was listening to that today, I absolutely loved the...
That was a fun thing to do. I was hoping at the time it would spin off a series. But
well, it has.
It finally has.
But
yeah,
I'm not writing it. there is talk of Dr. Spector being reprinted and then be revived by Dark Horse.
Oh, really?
And they just reprinted one of my stories in Volume 4 of Dr. Solar, Man of the Atom, because I did a couple Dr. Spectre stories where Dr. Soldar crossed over.
Okay.
And they reprinted that. And I guess now
people
are interested in Dr.
Valiant
Spectre
stuff?
Again.
No, it's a different...
different Solar Man of the Atom?
No, these are reprints.
These are the reprints. Well, I mean, the Valiant character is named after the same character, but I don't think it's the same.
Okay.
No, they change everything.
And
if you read my Dr. Spectre story where Solar appears, and if you read between the lines, he pretty much says that the reason you hadn't seen him in the last few years since his book was canceled was because he's been working for S.H.I.E.L.D. And he even mentions Nick, at least by his first name.
Nice.
So I had a lot of fun with that, too.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I tell you, I want to tell people real quickly about Witchblade, the anime series, another one of our fine sponsors, the folks over at Funimation. And Witchblade is now available on DVD and for digital download. It's based on the comic book series from Top Cow Productions. The anime series goes into the future to tell the tale of a new bearer of the Witchblade and the conspiracy that surrounds her burden. The 24-episode series box set features a wraparound art by Mark Silvestri. The box set includes 100 minutes of extra features, including all you want to know about Top Cow with interviews and a tour. Witchblade is also available as a download at iTunes, at the iTunes Music Store, and PS3 PlayStation Store, and Xbox. And it's also at Amazon, so pretty much any place that you can find a digital download for video, it's there at all of them. For more information, you can go to www.funimation.com/witchblade, and there you can view clips of the series and view the box art. But I would go to iTunes.
You were mentioning a little bit earlier that you've done some voices for some animated.
Speaking of anime.
Yeah, this is a very recent development. I never really thought of myself as an actor, except for the amateur movies I did. And I did a TV commercial back in the late 60s that I kind of stumbled into. But I never really thought of it as a career move because I don't like acting. I'm a little camera shy. I do great talking heads, you know, for an
interview. Right,
right. But acting, and I'm a director, so I'm constantly...
Like behind the camera.
In my mind, redirecting the scene the way I think it should be done, or... I can't stand the downtime. And when you're an actor, you can spend days on a set without being called.
Right.
Some actors just sit around. They don't even read a book. They just sit there. And I have a friend of mine named William Winkler who made a movie called... two he's most known for are The Double D Avenger, which is all the old Russ Meyer babes now, you know,
right.
Fighting crime. And then he did Frankenstein versus the Creature from Blood Cove. And we got to be friends. He came to the official screening of Teenage Movie Maker, and that's where I met him. And we become friends and helped us with our distribution and everything. But anyway, he got this job from Japan to take old 1980s Japanese TV series. They're editing them into feature-length movies, and we're dubbing them into English. And he said, why don't you try to do a couple of voices? I said, I can't do that. Well, it turns out I'm very good at it. It turned out I can do
a whole new career at this point in your life.
Yeah, I do a whole movie, and I can do lots of different kinds of voices. I do a whole movie in 20 minutes. I sit there. I don't see the script until it's in front of me on the teleprompter. I have no idea what the plot's about. And I just say the lines the way I think they should be said. 20 minutes later, it gives me $75 and I walk out.
What's like a sample line that you've had to say?
Well, I did one. I can't remember the line, but it was he wanted me to play a drunken old geezer scientist. And I did it like Gabby Hayes. So I talked like, we're going to lick those alien butt right now. You know what I mean? Like
that. You just need John Wayne in there.
I did Walter Brennan. I did Lon Chaney Jr. I did Walter Cronkite. I did Boris Karloff. I do all these. And I do my own voice. And then I raise it if I want to play a younger guy. I've done 8 movies now.
No kidding.
We've done, let me see, 3 Dangard Ace, 3 Guy King, and 2 Captain Harlock. And as soon as I go back, he's got like 3 or 4 new movies to do.
I'm to have you and Suntress do a voice off.
Yeah, no kidding.
So I'm one of the Guy King lead characters. I can't remember what his name was. And I don't remember. The weird thing is I don't remember, except for the leads, I do all these incidental voices, an announcer, a football coach.
Right, right.
And I don't remember. We do them so fast. Then we watch it. And then my friend Bill Winkler sits there and says, "That's you. That's you." And he points them all out. But the ironic thing, but the sad thing is, I'm in a position making pretty good money for very little work, acting in a job that I really don't like to do at all. I can't wait to get out of the studio. I'm doing only for the money, where most actors would kill to be in the position to do eight voiceover movies.
Sure,
it's a tough, it's a real tough business to get in. I was talking to June Foray, who was Rocky Squirrel and Speedy Alka-Seltzer. I mean, she's one of the classic voiceover people. And she said, it's real tough now for even the people that have made a living and a great career and have a lot of fame doing voiceovers, because now it's all celebrity voices.
Right, yeah, all the big
Pixar
animated
movies and things. It says Robin Williams.
Sure.
You know, John they Travolta, want somebody people that like that.
Right. No, absolutely. It's a different.
I almost feel guilty doing these things.
You know, there was one I was going to ask you. You know, I mean, you're certainly the epitome of an independent filmmaker. What do you think about, like, today? I mean, nowadays, a movie comes out from Miramax and they call it an independent film.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that?
Well,
our $20 million.
You know, like a lot of studios, when we think of movie studios, it's not like the studio system where the studio actually made movies.
Right.
A lot of these companies are just releasing companies now. So it could be, a studio might pick it up or whatever. But a lot of these movies are independents. You know, they raise a lot more money than I can.
Right.
You know, but then the studio will pick it up and release it.
It's more of a distribution.
Yeah, I mentioned the Beast in 20,000 Fathoms a while ago. That's a Warner Brothers film. But it was really an independent movie that Warner Brothers picked up
at that time.
Yeah.
What have you seen in you know, from say your first movie you did to this, you know, your newest movie? What do you think you've learned in that time?
Well, one thing I've learned is to always check out a techno person's credentials with personal references before you hire them. Sometimes, for instance, a cinematographer can have a great reel to show you with some beautiful shots, but what you don't realize, it takes them all day to set up one shot.
Right.
And when you're moving real fast, then you can't get all your coverage. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing I learned. Try to get to know your actors as much off-screen before you hire them as possible, because they can turn out to be real flakes and cause you real problems on set, which just costs you money, and then it's too late. Those are pretty much the two things I learned most. Well, of course, I learned how to make better movies.
Sure.
I learned how to hire, when I hire better people to be my line producers and people that I need on my team, I end up with a better movie. The current one is the best thing we've ever done. And largely because my line producer is an artist. He's got an artist sensibilities, mm-hmm. and he won't let a lot of slipshod things get by where a previous line producer would, because the attitude was, it's low budget, nobody's going to care, it's not going to sell one more DVD. His name's going on it. So it's got to be, you know, he fights to get it a certain way. And he's very, very good. He's also my editor. He was also my first AD, my first, assistant director, and wore a lot of other hats. We both wore many hats in this to get it all done.
What do you think it's easier today? Do you think it's easier or harder to do what you've done? For somebody to get into, whether it's writing. Well, I mean, whether it's writing. I mean, being a filmmaker, getting into these creative endeavors. Do you think it's easier today? Do you think it's harder today than
I think
when you did
a filmmaker
it?
Probably is easier in some ways, as long as you can raise the money to do it. That's the key issue. If you can raise the money to make your movie and end up with the movie, you can get people to look at it and, pick it up or whatever. You can distribute yourself. But without the money, you've got nothing.
Right.
If you're going the independent route. If you're going the studio route, pretty much almost everybody who's in the studio system has not gotten there on their talent. They've had somebody bring them in who's already there. And they keep tracing that back and forth, back to probably the people that got in on their own talent were the people who created the industry back in the silent movie days. There's an example I use when I give a lot of talks at seminars for actors. I'm telling them the importance of networking. And I tell them that here's the chain. That Catherine Zeta-Jones marrying Michael Douglas will not hurt her career in any way. It'll help her career. Of course, Michael Douglas, being the son of Kirk Douglas, really didn't hurt his career.
Right.
How did Kirk Douglas get in? Lauren Bacall, who had just married Humphrey Bogart, which made her a star,
sure.
foisted Kirk Douglas on some producer friend of hers. That's how Kirk Douglas got in. And how did Humphrey get in? When he's a kid, he lived teenager, he lived next door to a Broadway producer that put him in his first show. I don't know how the Broadway producer got in. That goes back to the Jurassic period. You know? Yeah.
But he probably had the money to do it.
You've got to have everybody there has had help in some way. And you watch the Academy Award shows and see how many people have familiar last names. I see interviews with people like Martin Landau. They say, well, you're getting older there. What's your family doing? Well, my son is directing this. My wife is producing that. My daughter has written the screenplay
for
this.
But on an independent level, I would imagine today, I mean, you know, listening to the last time you were on the show talking about, you know, working with, you know, the 16-millimeter cameras and doing the special effects and doing everything yourself, you know, and stunts and everything. I mean, today, with the way that the digital world is and how much cheaper it is, you know, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Not having to pay for film.
Cheaper, faster. You don't have to. I mean, I would when I shot things in black and white, it would take me 5 working days to get the film back, to see it, to see if you even had an image.
Right.
If it turned out. And during that 5 days, it was horrendous. The agony waiting to see what you shot. And you could only afford maybe 3 minutes of film, a 1-roll, 100-foot roll in 16-millimeter.
Well, now, literally with $7,000, maybe $10,000, you can have the high definition camera, the mics, the computer, and the editing software.
Yeah. You know how I edited? Yeah. I held up the film to the light and looked at it and tried, you know, to see what the images were and try to make matching cuts and then glue them together. And then I would be paranoid because every time you made a splice, you lost a frame on either side.
Yeah.
And if it didn't hold, if it broke, you had to
slice it again.
And pretty soon you didn't have a scene anymore. Yeah. And now it's in nonlinear editing with Avids and, you know, Pro Tools and all these things. And, but also, nowadays, you can find books and DVDs and TV documentaries and things telling you how to make movies.
Right.
Nobody
right.
told me when I was learning, you know, making amateur films in Chicago. You figured it out.
Well, I think, you know, listening to the last time you were on, one of the things that you talked about that kind of stuck with me was you were talking about how sort of lucky you were that you never had the problem of just writing. You know, you had said that you just were able to, whenever, you know, you just were able to write, sit down and write, and that's, you know, what.
Oh, yeah. Well, I firmly believe that whatever that we all have certain abilities, certain talents, whatever you want to call them, whatever those are, that's what's easy for you. You know, like artists, I have artist friends of mine who sit there all day doing painting. How did you get the idea for this? I never could have done it. Or some people who write great music, you know, or people who are. Athletic or whatever, that's natural to them.
Mm-hmm.
And to them, it just comes easy. And the stories just come to me. It's nothing difficult about it.
Sandy. Well, I think we could go on and on and talk for hours. Unfortunately, we need to wrap things up here. Before we do, though, I want to say, Don, thank you so much again for dropping by. And anytime
you want me on the show when I'm in town, I'd love to do it.
Just
I have a good
one.
Time. I get to talk about things I don't usually get to talk about. It's usually the same old thing.
And you usually come into Chicago, what, a couple times a year?
Usually around the major holidays.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll be in around Christmas and New Year's, you know, again. And then maybe Easter might be. My mother is in the hospital again, and she's going to be 91 next month. Mm. So it depends on her condition. If she's still with me next year, I'll be here more often because I want, you know, I have things to take care of with her.
Sure.
So, anytime you want me to just send me an email or I'll let you know.
Just drop us a line.
Definitely
know
a pleasure.
You're welcome anytime that you're in town.
Anybody who's out there wants to come to the Portage Theater. Remember,
yes.
The
yes.
night
Friday,
after
this Friday, night
after
Thanksgiving.
We can meet. You can buy a DVD if you want one and meet and Count Gord Duvall.
What time does it start?
7:30.
Starts
and
7:30.
That's on Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago, right off of... what is it? Off of Irving Park, I think.
Yeah, it's Portage Park, basically. Yeah. A classic old Chicago movie theater. So
yeah. I'd never been. It's huge. It's enormous.
Awesome. Well, good. I'll
we need to fill it up. I don't want to be embarrassed and have an empty.
I'll try.
My mother can't come this time. You know, she helped out last time.
Well, I will try and make it out there this week. Before we go here, I want to remind people that that you can email the show at info@aroundcomics.com. We have some emails coming up on the next episode. It is the holiday season is quickly approaching, and we want to remind folks to stop that. We want to remind people to. donate to the Hero Initiative. It is a fantastic charity that benefits veteran creators that are
bring my jingle bells next time.
You got tied into the end of the holiday season, but you guys, listeners out there, should know about the Hero Initiative by now, and it is a great charity. I'm going to sweeten the pot a little bit.
Oh,
this is we've made it very easy to donate. All you have to do is go to aroundcomics.com, and we have a PayPal link, and you can donate right there. You can also call them at 310-909-7809, and you'll have some information on how you can donate, or you can go to heroinitiative.org. Well, we talked about Witchblade, and I'm going to grab my little gift bag here. We had the fine folks at Funimation sent some nice product our way, and I have the complete Witchblade series on DVD.
Ooh.
I have the complete first season of Afro Samurai, the director's cut, and it's the deluxe edition on DVD. You had seen this.
I did, yes.
Absolutely gorgeous packaging. It's the complete first season of Afro Samurai.
Sam
and,
Jackson.
Not from, that stuff is from Funimation. This is from Rich Kozlowski, Windy City Comic Con alum. He sent some copies of The King, which is one of my favorite books and one that I give out to a lot of people that have maybe never read a comic before that are Elvis fans. It is a great introductory comic for a lot of people, or if you're an Elvis fan, it's a lot of fun. And I have four signed editions of The King. So if you donate to the Hero Initiative and email me at chris@aroundcomics.com and just let me know that you donated to the Hero Initiative, you can, you know, send a copy of your PayPal receipt, whatever. And let me know.
What are you doing? The first four? Are you gonna do a raffle?
You know,
do it for a week or 2 weeks.
Well, we'll do a raffle, and in your email, let me know what you would prefer, in order of the complete Witchblade anime series on DVD, the Afro Samurai director's cut, or a copy of The King signed by Rich Kozlowski.
So we have six items, right?
Yeah,
four Kings.
And you know what? My wife keeps telling me to get rid of stuff, so I can probably throw some other stuff in for the folks.
Yeah, me too. I probably got a bunch of stuff at home I could throw in there. But yeah, why don't we do that? We'll do it for until the next episode.
Yep.
So 2 weeks from when you hear this on Monday.
Yep. And make it. I don't want to pressure anyone too much, but make it at least a $10.
$10
or more.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, and hey, $10. That's hell, you can't even buy three comic books for $10 anymore.
Yeah, no kidding.
So all right. So so there you go. Help support the Hero Initiative. It's great. I want to thank everyone that left us an iTunes music review here lately. Our latest iTunes music reviewer is Jay Leiston. Or
Leiston?
It's Leiston. Leiston. So it's a great way to help promote the show. Go to the iTunes music store and leave us a review. Visit our forum at aroundcomics.com. We have a great discussion on comics for young readers going on there.
Yeah.
So it's speaking of the holidays, if you're looking for getting them, the youngsters.
Forum seems
funny
to be on an upswing lately.
Yeah, yeah.
There's like a lot of posting going on of late.
It's good. Yeah, it's good. Glad everyone is there. Tom versus the Flash, check that out as Tom walks you through DC history one comic at a time. I started working out this week and I listened to Tom versus the
Flash. It's, you know, it makes you run faster.
It makes me faster. Yeah, it does. All right. Especially whenever he bitches about Iris Allen.
He's just jealous of Iris.
I think you're right. I'm on 11 o'clock comics every week. Vince B, who is a huge Don Glute fan, so you have a fan there. So he'll be very jealous again this week.
Yes, he will.
Whenever I tell him that you drop by. And check out my column at ifanboy.com, comic shots, which I got to get my column in.
Yeah,
you
ever going to get that?
Oh, I tell you what, it's been rough.
You're a busy
here,
man.
All right, once again, I want to thank Don Glute so much for dropping by.
No,
Sal,
thank you for
having
me.
Always good to have you here. I want to thank Mr. Beatty for hosting us here at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles. As always, everyone have a great rest of your week and weekend. We'll be back again on Monday with another full-length episode. In the meantime,
in between time,
we'll be everywhere in
and around comics.
I'm in the phone booth. Yeah.
views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and may not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Any reproduction, rebroadcast, or retransmission without the express written consent of Around Comics is strictly prohibited. All content presented in this program is the sole property of Around Comics, and this has been an Around Comics production, copyright 2008.